Welcome to this mini-series of Data for What, the Development Gateway podcast. Over the course of four episodes, we will explore open data, data governance, and privacy, as well as the many challenges and opportunities within these topics. I'm your host, Beverly Hatrimbu. In episode two, we have the privilege of some really fantastic guests who will intro us to the strengths, risks, and challenges in open data and data protection. My conversation with our guests today will touch on data protection impact assessments, talking a little bit about when they should be conducted and how their findings should be addressed and incorporated. And we'll also talk generally about trends in open data and data protection and how those two quote unquote movements work side by side. Let's get right to the episode.
So today we'll offer you two wonderful people grappling with these aspects of data from different perspectives. We have Natalia Carfi, who's all about open data, and we have Sui-Lang Harris, who will help us better understand some of the risks and limitations around data. So let's dive right in. So maybe Natty, do you want to go first?
My name is Natty Carfi. Well, Natalia, but everybody calls me Natty. I'm the executive director of the Open Data Charter. I've been working in the Open Data Charter for almost 4 years now. In my prior life, I used to be a public official working also in open government and open data. So it's been a little bit over 10 years now that I've been part of this community. As a hobby, something that's not work related, I sing.
I love that. So Sui-Lang, now you're on the hook. You've got to share something cool that you do that is not related to your work.
The pressure. So my name is Sui-Lang Harris. I am a director of litigation at Luminate, which is a global philanthropic organization. And I am very much focused on human rights as they intersect with data and data-driven systems. So I think there's probably a lot that Nati and I agree on, as well as have different sort of focal points. And something interesting about me that's not work-related, I really like yoga.
So Nati, can you help us understand what is open data? And also on a more personal level, how did you end up working in this space?
Open data is data that is openly accessible, exploitable, editable, and shared by anybody for any purpose, even commercial use, and that is licensed under an open license. So one example is when you talk about a PDF document. PDF documents, everybody has gone through the process of trying to copy and paste what was in a PDF. And then you have to be around 15 minutes trying to organize whatever got pasted in the Word document that you pasted that in. That is not a reusable format. You haven't been able to reuse the data that was inside that document, that PDF document, easily. So PDF is considered we have a 5 stars ranking of openness for open data. PDF is considered just 1 star because you'd rather have the PDF out than not having the data published in any format. But it's a really, really difficult format to reuse. So that example always, like, it's super approachable because everybody has gone through that process of trying to copy and paste that information there, that data there. So the idea is to be as transparent as possible, and that's where also the privacy conversations comes in, but I know we're going to be talking about that in a little while. How I ended up in the open data community, it's not so clear. I was working in modernization back in 2010, kind of trying to reorganize internal systems in a public office. And as a researcher at that time, I was working on public participation, like on another side of my work. And then I started reading about open government, and it kind of seemed like a mixture of what I was practically doing, like trying to digitize systems and data within the public sector and public participation, which was what I was researching. So I started researching a little bit more about open government and open data and kind of the Obama administration first act that actually talked about open government and open data as kind of the same thing. And that's probably how I got started, like trying to understand if open government made sense as kind of a framework for what I was doing and how I could relate kind of the more practical side of my work and the more theoretical part of my work. And then fortunately, I am still in Buenos Aires City, where open data kind of picked up really, really fast. So I then heard about a hackathon and I went there like super scared, like what is going on, but I need to understand who's doing this, who's organizing this. And then I just went we had like one hackathon per weekend throughout like 3 years. The open data community started to develop really, really fast. And that's actually how I got started.
So Sweelang, turning to you, similarly, when you talk about protecting data, what do you mean? And what kinds of data are we talking about here?
The words themselves, data protection, they sound like it's just a concern about privacy. But actually, data protection law as it's developed in the EU is better understood as a bundle of different rights that people have in relation to data that can identify them. So there's a right to be informed if personal data about you is being processed and you might not be aware of it. There's rights to object to certain kinds of data processing, because if the data related to you is being processed in certain ways that you're not happy about and that you don't consent to and that don't serve legitimate interests, you can object to that. And the main kind of data that we are concerned about is so-called personal data, which is personally identifiable information. For better and for worse, that is the distinction that EU law has drawn, i.e. they've drawn a distinction between non-personal data and personal data, even though some would rightly say that non-personal data can still have important human rights consequences, especially, for example, if you get to household levels of granularity on something like water use.
How did you end up working in this space?
So I started my professional career as a lawyer in Australia, and I've always had an interest in human rights, in power, and in accountability. And as our world has moved increasingly to a digital world and an online world, we see that that is where and how power is exercised in many cases. And so I'm not necessarily particularly interested in the tech per se, but I'm very interested in the impact that data-driven systems have on people and their lives.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue, I think, to the next question for you, Natty, about what are some of the strengths that, like, your top three biggest strengths of open data, because I think a part of the movement and the approach is around sort of breaking down those silos, breaking down sort of some of those power struggles over data and information. So Natty, from your perspective, what are the three strengths?
When we're talking about governmental open data, we're talking about culture change. So one of the strengths that I see in open data policies within governments is that we are working towards changing the mindset and the way that governments work. So the first data systems within governments weren't thought of to be open. Like they weren't created for that. And so civil servants and public officials have been working for a long, long time in the same way, not even thinking, because they didn't have to, that the data that they are creating is actually owned by citizens and not by them, that citizens have the right to access that information. And so it's not just about the technical bit of opening up data, which can be super easy or not, depending on which type of data we're talking about, but it's the biggest challenge and what the strength for me is about open data policies being implemented is the culture change that it means. And that's why it also takes time, because it's not just about like pressing a button and say, okay, so here are the data sets. It's working with civil servants, with public officials, maybe changing laws and changing the way that the government is actually conceived. So that is one of the core strengths. Then, of course, the transparency / accountability bit of it. Of course, opening up data actually enhances any transparency policy that you might have, and it allows for better accountability of what the government is doing or not doing, and how they are doing what they're doing. So that is, of course, one of the strengths, and probably the first justification that ever existed of open data, kind of a proactive transparency agenda. And so for the non-proactive bit, you had the laws, and for this, like the freedom of information laws and access to information laws, and then this proactive way of actually publishing governmental data. And then probably the third one is the innovation that can actually happen because of the data that is being opened. So there's kind of locked public value in the data that is being created, that if the data is not being opened, it will be kept locked. And that's what amazes me, kind of the never-ending possibilities of reuse. Like, we could sit among ourselves to discuss what to do with a certain data set, and if we bring just one more person, his, her, or their perspective would, like, will change the way that we reuse that data set, and will bring another possibility of reuse. I would say that kind of culture change, the transparency, which is still for me a very big important thing, even if it's the older one, and innovation.
Yeah, that bringing of new ideas, or just leaving data open to new ideas. I love the term culture change, because I think that's so much of what is cool, what can be cool about data. And I think, Sweelang, we know well that with culture change also comes some risks. So talk to us a little bit around what some of the potential risks are when increasingly more data is available and open.
One of the issues is that in the gathering and publication of data, there is the risk of the data that you're collecting. So for example, in the UK, there's a really important public sector duty, the equalities duty, which is an obligation for public sector organisations to promote equalities and to address inequality. And a really important way of monitoring that from an accountability perspective could be the collection of equalities data. So data about how men versus women navigate a particular public process and whether there's disproportionately good or bad outcomes for one or the other group. But of course, the more of that kind of sensitive data that you're collecting about people, the more that you're de facto creating a database about the sensitive characteristics of individuals, and you can be creating a database of vulnerable individuals. And if, in fact, that's what one ends up doing, even though you might have tried to depersonalize it or anonymize it or what have you in order to make it as secure as possible, there's still a risk that a vulnerable population is being effectively surveilled, even with good intentions. Another example of the risks is one that's close to my heart as a former lawyer, which is legal data, case law data. So it's a really important principle, especially in common law systems, that there should be open justice. The idea that most courtrooms most of the time are public. Anyone from the public could walk into that courtroom and witness what is going on and understand how the justice system is working. And an important aspect of that has been the publication of judgments and decisions, so that because common law builds on previous decisions by judges, it's important to have information about what has been decided publicly available so that people understand the development of the law. But as we move from an analog world to a digital world, suddenly the personal information about people involved in court cases appears on the internet, potentially forevermore, and appears in Google searches about people, for example, even if they were not a defendant, they weren't accused of anything, they might just have been a witness, but their name might nevertheless appear in the court records, and that can lead to stigma, especially when you then have layered on top of that data-driven systems, algorithmic systems that are trying to assess risk. And as part of that risk assessment are looking at public records data like housing disputes or workplace disputes. So on the one hand, it's extremely important that there's open justice and that information about what's happening in the courts is publicly available. On the other hand, how do we manage thoughtfully the impact on individuals when personal information about them is identifiable in those legal data?
I think that's a really helpful overview, because we're talking about risk at multiple levels, on the individual level as far as access to justice. It's nuanced. But Natty, you can speak to that as well, because it's not as though the open data community isn't aware of some of these risks and also proactively trying to solve them. So from your perspective, where do you see some of the challenges?
as kind of a rethinking of the open data community, or maybe a revision of what we did, because there was kind of a decision to say a couple of years ago that we turned 10 as a community and kind of make a revision of what had been done, what was okay, what wasn't. And one of the major discussions was that we didn't connect that well with kind of the privacy community, with the privacy organizations. We were just like open data. We connected with each other and just went for it. And we needed to take a step back, try to understand better, because of course it's not that we didn't know the privacy community existed, but like try to engage, build those bridges, have discussions, understand each other's points of view better than we did, even collaborate when possible, because of course it's important to try to address the commonalities, but also the points where we disagree. There has been a really proactive kind of change in that, and we have been able to connect, engage, even create panels and roundtables to discuss together, and as I said, try to better understand each other's points of view. We kind of all advocate for, of course, as open data and privacy folks on privacy, but also understand that the better understanding of each other's points of view, it's also a better result in advocacy towards governments. Absolutely. And a better regulation and like more rights for people, you know, better rights for people. So I don't think we can, like, I can point out to a specific result right now, just understanding that we're like, for example, if you see now the agenda of events like RightsCon, you will see a lot more of open data folks there trying to bring in these discussions into the digital rights events, where they were more prone towards like privacy panels, and now you will see open data discussions there. These types of things, like the RightsCon agenda, or things where you see open data people trying to participate to bring those discussions into light. I think it's part of what we're seeing of this new approach of being more open to having these discussions, understanding where we agree and where we don't, and it's okay. But at least acknowledging a better acknowledgement of this conversation.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point to highlight, because I think, and Suilang will talk about this next a little bit, but even the active data protection impact assessments, a part of that is really understanding that the mandate and the ownership around data and the influence and the ways that people are able to influence data, it differs. It's not always in one community or one agency or the other. It requires a lot of different actors to work together. So I know that data protection impact assessments may look different by organization and by sector, but what is someone looking for? What's the top line definition that could help someone figure out whether they're looking at a data protection impact assessment or not?
So the top line thing that you're looking for is, will this data processing, and that can include gathering of data or the deletion of data or the combining of one data set with another data set, let alone the application of an algorithm, will this data processing have, or could it have, a significant impact on people's rights and freedoms? And that obviously includes the right to privacy, but it also, as I said, includes concerns about discrimination, and where it's a public decision-making system, it could affect things like the right to housing or social welfare. So that's the social question. Should I do a data protection impact assessment? If it's going to have, or it could have, a significant impact on people's rights and freedoms, yes.
Great. That sounds deceptively simple.
But then, of course, you're thinking about, ideally, how is the system going to work and how is it going to affect the data subjects that are going to encounter the system? And not just the sort of maybe 80% of quote-unquote normal, or, you know, what the majority of the population looks like, but including and especially what are the outliers going to look like? What, where might a system accidentally generate false positives or false negatives? For example, in the UK, the system for granting an immigration status to EU citizens who were living in the UK when Brexit happened was a digital by default system and used automated name matching or automated data matching in order to verify applicants' identities. But there were reportedly many issues in terms of the different naming traditions of different cultures. Some languages that don't use the English alphabet, and therefore the transliteration of names coming up differently in different systems, or systems just not being able to work with each other. And that's a fairly basic impact in that people were not able to assert their identity in order to get their immigration status, which ideally, had a thorough impact assessment being conducted, might have been avoided if there'd been consultation with all 27 EU member states and consideration of their different cultures as regards to naming and language.
That's really at the heart of what a well thought out data protection impact assessment is doing, is really thinking through impact, both intended and unintended. So, Suilang, sort of related to that point, you've written and talked about how data protection impact assessments can help make data both usable and protected. Can you speak a bit more about why you think that is, and in what context DPIAs can be valuable?
The most important thing about data protection impact assessments is that they're crucial where there might be a significant impact on people's rights and freedoms. And that's not just the right and freedom of privacy, but all rights and freedoms, including non-discrimination. And so in EU law under the GDPR, that's when they're required. So it's not that every single kind of data processing needs to have a thorough and exhaustive data protection impact assessment conducted, but where the data processing could have a significant impact on people's rights and freedoms, that's when they're legally required in the EU. And there's a real convergence there between the direction of travel of data protection law in EU and the more general human rights law that we've got from international human rights conventions. The Ruggie principles on business and human rights similarly ask that there's due diligence done, that there's consideration made of the impact that businesses can have on human rights, and that should extend to the digital world as it does to the physical analog world. The particular area that I've focused on in relation to data protection impact assessments is government digital systems and decision-making systems. It's really important that when these public systems are being designed and developed, the ways that they can and should work for people and the ways that they might inadvertently not work for people are considered at the beginning, and that the design is as human rights centered as possible. And that's the function that data protection impact assessments can serve, especially ideally if they're done in an open process with public participation. And if they're published afterwards, one of the real lost opportunities of data protection in the EU so far is that there hasn't been a tendency to publish data protection impact assessments. And so without that data being open, we don't know necessarily, was an assessment done? If it was done, what risks were identified and how are they being managed or mitigated? A lot more sort of both open data and learnings from the open data community could really benefit the data protection impact assessment process in Europe, but also the world more broadly.
More broadly. And one of the sort of unintended outputs around data privacy is its impact on open data. So, Natty, how have you seen privacy regulations have some potential negative impacts, open data and access to information more broadly?
Yes, there has been the golden standard is kind of GDPR, and it has an impact only European Union countries. It has had impact pretty much everywhere on kind of a national legislation impact, but also for citizens, where there's countries where there's a lot of European immigrants living, and they can uphold the right for GDPR in the countries where they're living. So it has created a lot of impacts other than just for European Union members. And that is something that is not being kind of researched on.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like we've lost count of the number of countries who've based their data protection or other laws based lock, stock and barrel on GDPR.
Yeah. And for example, I come from Argentina. We have a huge Italian and Spanish communities here that do have the double nationality. So they are Italo-Argentinian or Spanish-Argentinian. And those citizens actually have the right to do requests under the GDPR process in their countries where they're living. So it is actually creating...
I didn't even think of that.
Yeah. It is actually creating, like, it's not even on a national level, but it's like micro cases, if you want to call it in some way. So that is something that needs to be more explored. That is not what the Open Data Charter is gonna explore. But coming from an Italo-Argentinian family, it's something that actually came up. Other than that, we've seen how GDPR has had an impact, and that we have seen rollbacks of data sets that had been published that are not published anymore because of government's concerns of complying with GDPR. So, for example, on public procurement, the list of companies and the names of the owners of the companies that are actually working with governments, like, are there personal data or not, and just in case, in order to be able to comply, at least in the first during the first years of implementing GDPR, those data sets were taken out of the open data portals. They are slowly coming around, and as governments and actually the European Union figures out the implementation of GDPR, because it's still going on. It's a really robust piece of legislation, and understanding how it's being implemented, it's of course going to take time. But we've seen cases like that. Then, of course, I don't know exact causes of that. There might be some governments that actually took the advantage to just roll back those data sets. I really don't know if that was the case, but I know that there were actually like real concerns about complying with GDPR and not having the specific answer on what to do in such cases. And the European Union is also moving towards the data directory that they're publishing and things like that. But the open data conversation seems to have been lost throughout the GDPR conversation. Maybe we should have done a better job there in taking a thorough look on what was going on, because we've seen cases like this pretty much everywhere. Of course, open data community is always aware and has been advocating to kind of roll back those rollbacks, so kind of republish what was taken out of the open data portals. But I think it's going to take some time to make those adjustments, because as I said, GDPR is still kind of rolling and governments are still understanding what they can and cannot do. And we're talking just about governmental open data. The impact on privately created and owned data, it's even another conversation, but we're focusing specifically on governmental open data. So I think it's something that, like, I don't have a proper answer right now. It is something that we will be researching throughout the year to better understand how we can help thoroughly understand the impact of privacy laws on open data, and specifically, of course, GDPR being kind of the most robust one that we've seen so far.
That's a really interesting framing. I think you've both done an artful job of sort of drawing the link between sort of culture change, innovation, rights and freedoms. So now, where is the sweet spot in your view? You know, where is open data the most useful, and where are protections and safety concerns the most negligible in order to make those four broad themes come together in the most seamless way?
I think that although there are still important human rights considerations to bear in mind, non-personal data, generally speaking, presents much fewer human rights risks and is therefore a sort of more obvious candidate for having as open data. And I think in particular, open data about government systems, about public systems, is critically important for public accountability and for democracy, as Nati has already been articulating really beautifully. I would also say that private sector algorithmic systems, data-driven systems, should also be subject to a high degree of transparency and accountability. Things like credit scoring systems, or even the way that social media operates, where there's high hopes in civil society in Europe at the moment for the Digital Services Act requiring certain kinds of data to be accessible in some way, even if not entirely openly, from the big tech platforms, so that people are not dealing with black box systems in their lives that are completely opaque in terms of what information they receive, what decisions are made about them, and just how they navigate the world online and offline. So again, I think it comes down to enough information to have transparency and accountability where there's an impact on people's lives without ideally revealing sensitive personal information about the people involved.
I can only second what Sweet said. And it's just like, maybe share like a practical example. There's a zillion apps now that use public transportation routes that the data was made available through open data portals and APIs and actually helped everyday life for everybody, like and those are based on open data. And now the question around that, and that has been around forever, is like, since open data kind of started, is do we want citizens to know that that app is, it's even possible because the data has been open, or just being like being able to make one person's lives easier that day because they can go to the train station or to the bus stop on time, knowing that the train or the bus is going to come on that specific time, and making his, her day life easier just enough. It's been around 20 years and there's no one proper answer, depending on who you speak with. Data sets like with non-personal data that actually help with everyday life decisions for citizens, that's the best middle ground, I think, that we can talk about. And that kind of public transportation routes is the go-to data set, for an example.
Open data has really been sort of the word and the go-to phrase for the last 20 years or so. What trends are you seeing going forward that you think are really going to shape the open data and open government community?
At the beginning of the open data policies, at least on my perspective, the call was to open data, like any data, without even thinking about why, just like having an open data portal and just pushing data there. We've been able to do an evaluation, and it was actually Open Data Charter that came up with the idea, with the concept of publish with a purpose. So understanding the problem that you're trying to solve by publishing open data. So open data as a means towards another end, and not open data as an end itself. And with that in regard, we've had kind of a couple of years where the open data kind of euphoria kind of went down a little bit. But with the pandemic, we've seen now a new kind of call, because of the need of citizens to understand what was going on, what the governments were doing, where the changes in public budget and spending were happening to respond to the pandemic. So there was like a new wave of open data, and we've worked with the GovLab in New York around this third wave of open data concept. And so I think the open data movement has slowly but steadily moved towards thematic approach. So you're seeing more specialized civil society organizations, journalists, and areas in governments that are pushing thematic open data agenda. So climate change, open data for climate change agenda, or open data for gender pay gap. It's not even the gender agenda. It's like going, even like double clicking on a big topic. So it's climate change for gender pay gap agenda. Well, the anti-corruption agenda is still a massive one for open data. So you're seeing like, and I think that is going to be what happens throughout the next few years. We're going to see small, I don't want to call it clusters, but because I don't want to bring like any negative vision around that, but more specialized groups working on thematic approach of open data. So I think that's how it's going to go. And because of that, the privacy conversation is also going to come in easily. You know, we will be focusing on gender pay gap, open data, but also bringing in those specialists from the privacy perspective that can actually work on getting the right balance between openness and privacy for that topic, because privacy is not the same for every topic. You know, you need to understand it, the context or the theme that you're talking about. So I think we're going to be seeing more and more kind of, if you will, solutions to this kind of balancing problem towards thematic discussions.
That's interesting. So you see that the move to thematic will actually create more opportunities rather than less in terms of synergy with privacy or other subject areas.
Definitely.
That's interesting. So Sweelang, if people didn't think data protection was super cool before, it's about to be, you know, it's already here, I feel like. What trends are you seeing, or you think that we'll start to see going forward around data protection?
Truthfully, I'm not sure these are predictions so much as a wish list of what I want to see. But echoing Nati's point, context matters. And I think there's an increasing awareness that the context that produced data sets in which they were constructed and gathered really matter. And you can't necessarily just repurpose data without paying attention to the context in which it was originally collected, what was the purpose and so on. So I think a renewed attention to the context of data is something I really want to see, and I think we are seeing. And then a broader understanding of the human rights that can be affected by data-driven systems is crucial. It's not, privacy is of course hugely important, so is freedom of expression, but it's not just those two rights. When you're talking about automated decisions related to immigration, then people's rights to family life can be affected. Mm. When you're talking about automated decisions concerning housing allocation, then people's right to housing can be affected. One of the key concerns for Luminate at the moment is democratic discourse and the impact of social media and large digital media platforms on democratic discourse. And what does that do to our democratic rights? What kind of democracy do we live in if voter suppression is happening in a micro-targeted, opaque fashion through social media? So I think hopeful and looking forward to both open data communities and the privacy communities expanding the aperture to think about the full cohort, the full panoply of human rights, and not be too focused on just a couple of rights to the exclusion of all others.
Absolutely. I think that's a great point to end on. But before I let you go, you've both been so generous with your time. What are you both reading, listening to, or watching that's helping you sort of think through some of the issues we've talked about today?
I follow, of course, what ODI is doing, then Data for Development blog posts, also responsible data mailing group also. So I would recommend people to just join mailing groups. There's a lot of super interesting discussions going on there. I also always take a look at Ada Lovelace, what they are doing. The African Open Data Network also has reading recommendations each month. I always follow up on what they are also doing. ILDA, the Iniciativa Latinoamericana de Datos Abiertos, also has a mailing group, and I always follow what they are doing, just trying to understand what everybody's researching about. And the most interesting things are kind of the conversations in the mailing group.
Thanks, Natty. How about you, Sweelang?
So I am reading a book called An Ugly Truth at the moment, which is by Shira Frankel and Cecilia Kang. It's about the rise of Facebook and the business decisions and design decisions that were made along the way in shaping that particular data-driven system.
One of the things I've been listening to is the Center for International Governance Innovation. They have a podcast hosted by Taylor Owen, and they've got some really good, lots of really different subjects over time. But the two episodes that stand out to me, one was with Naomi Klein. She's tracked big tech for years and the influencer economy before it was cool. And she's raising some really critical red flags around how companies are positioning themselves to provide essential services. So this sort of comes back to that. They're taking advantage of some of the open data that governments are making available to them, but then it's also getting monetized and sort of used for gain and less so about improving public services. So she talks about some of those struggles in that episode, which I really enjoyed. And then another episode more recently was around Indigenous data. In my non-work life, I've been reading Braiding Sweetgrass, which is all about its sort of Indigenous knowledge, knowledge pathways. And I've been thinking a lot about how we approach data if we're looking at it from a collective rather than from the individual. I think the predominant position is around individual rights, but what if we were looking at things from a collective or communal perspective? You all have been so accommodating to all of my grilling. Thank you so much for the conversation. I've learned so many different things. I can't wait to share this with the rest of the world.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Thank you so much, Beverly. It was fun.
Special thanks to our guests, and thanks to our producers behind the scenes, Lindsay Fincham, Annalisa Goodman, and Becca Warner. This episode was produced by Lindsay Fincham and edited by Annalisa Goodman. Our theme music was created by Mark Hatcher. Learn more about Development Gateway and IRX Venture on our website at developmentgateway.org or through our social media.